Hello and welcome to the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, journalists, scholars, filmmakers, musicians, and collectors. Anything to do with pop culture and the national pastime. Our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Well, hello again, everybody. As you might be hearing in this introduction, I'm still in the same situation bird-wise as I was last week. So you might hear a few chirps in the background. Sorry, unavoidable in the current circumstance. Having made those excuses, on with the show. It seems only fitting that I should follow up last week's chat with Paul Dixon, author of Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son, with Marty Appel, author of Casey Stengel, Baseball's Greatest Character. Both books tell the stories of men who enjoyed a lifetime connection with the national pastime. Appel, a former PR director for the New York Yankees, has worked on publicity campaigns for dozens of books that have contributed to the knowledge and enjoyment of readers. One of my favorite short pieces of his is an article on baseball titles that appear on the New York Times bestseller list, which I will link to on the blog. He is also the author of dozens of his own books, including Pinstripe Empire, The Definitive History of the Bronx Bombers. His first book, Baseball's Best, The Hall of Fame Gallery, was originally published 40 years ago. So happy anniversary, Marty. It's always a pleasure and an education to chat with him. Marty Appel, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Good to be back with you, Ron. Enjoy this.
Well, this is an exciting time for you. It's always an exciting time when a book comes out, and you've written so many. Does it ever get old?
No, it's not like they come once a week. It's more like every few years, so I'm certainly look forward to the process. It's very enjoyable, and I'm glad people are calling and are interested in the subject.
And talking about the subject, the book is a biography of Casey Stengel. What prompted you to do something like this now? He's been out of the scene for quite a while.
That's part of the motivation. He didn't deserve to be forgotten, and I came to the conclusion while I was doing this that almost nobody under 40 had even heard of him, let alone his accomplishments. The original impetus came when the MLB Network used to do a thing that they call Prime 9, like the best baseball movies and the best relief pitcher. And they did the greatest characters in baseball history, and Casey was named number one, baseball's greatest character. So we made that the subhead of the book, the subtitle, and my editor, Jason Kaufman, was all aboard with doing this, even though Bob Creamer had done this masterful biography 35 years ago.
So, 35 years ago, so what, I mean, it's not like he's done anything lately, so what is new about your version of his life?
Well, that was the key, because I was a little intimidated by doing something that Bob Creamer had done, and, you know, what's the point if less you have different stuff? But when he did it, the Internet wasn't yet up and flourishing and available to him. So with the Internet available to me, I was able to tap into the archives of all the little newspapers in the small minor league towns where Casey first played, and even the Brooklyn Eagle when he played and managed for Brooklyn. So a lot of good anecdotes long buried were recovered. Then Casey's grandniece, a wonderful woman named Toni Harsh, made available to me an unpublished memoir by Casey's wife, Edna Stengel, a full book. She wrote it in 1958. It was never published. Yeah. And it was a whole other side of Casey.
Sure.
Not the baseball man, but the husband. And, there's the courtship and the wedding and things that had not been covered before. So what a great find that was. So with that, I was off to the races.
And obviously, when you come across something like that, I mean, people forget. Yeah, they only think of most of these people as in uniform, on the field, or in the front office, as baseball people, but not as people. And Casey was a real people person.
He absolutely was. And he also embraced the baseball community. He never big-leagued anybody. To him, the fans, the autograph guys at the airport, it was all part of the family. So he used to, for instance, he lived in the Essex House on Central Park South all the years he managed the Yankees and the Mets. And after games, to unwind, instead of going up to his suite, he'd walk all around from the entrance of the Essex House down to 6th Avenue, south to 58th Street, back up 58th to the rear entrance of the Essex House, all the while loving being recognized, talking about that day's game with the fans, talking old baseball stories. This was one of his rituals, and he just loved being part of the fans. Even in retirement, late in life, he loved going to the supermarket and being recognized and talking baseball.
Now, one of the things you mentioned earlier in the conversation, you talk about, you know, people under 40 might not know who Stengel is. People under 40 probably don't realize that back in the day when Stengel was first coming up, when he was playing, even up until he was managing the Yankees, most cities had more than one newspaper, and the newspapers were the only way that fans could get news. This was before television, and when Casey was starting out, it was just really the beginnings of radio sports coverage. So you are an author of a certain age, so you have been doing this before, like you say, you've been doing this before the Internet. So what is the difference like, if there is one, in the style that you write, aside from the research, because like you say, you obviously have access to a lot more newspapers, digitized newspapers through the Internet.
Well, I don't know if it changes my style at all, and really I don't absorb myself in every possible story written today about the game. I'm still kind of a traditionalist. I'll turn to the newspapers first. I don't listen to sports talk radio all day long. I would imagine that would have made Casey crazy to have that in his life. But for me, you're right, I'm of a certain age. I'm a baby boomer. When I grew up, Casey was the father figure. When I remember I was 12 when he was fired, and I was thinking, like, they're never going to win another game. How could they possibly get rid of Casey Stengel?
So the Yankees fired Stengel in 1960, and he's one of these guys who, like you say, baseball is his whole life. He started as a player in the 1920s, and he kept on going, if not officially in an employment capacity, but as an ambassador to the game until his death practically, which is well over 50 years. So he took a year or so off, and then he became the manager of the Mets. Now, how did that work out? I mean, here you're used to managing a team of champions. They won all those World Series in a row, and now you're starting basically from scratch. You know, how did he adapt to that?
Well, of course, it recalled his managing days before the Yankees, when he managed a succession of teams that were all low-budget, second-division finishers. That was his reputation when he came to the Yankees, an entertaining guy, but not a very good manager because he had terrible teams. He put that reputation of success at risk when he went to the Mets, at high risk, but actually it didn't hurt him at all. It made him a beloved ambassador for the game. The Mets franchise still is built on the foundation Casey Stengel built for him when he talked about the amazing Mets. And it didn't seem to matter. It didn't seem to hurt his reputation. He went into the Hall of Fame the year after he retired from the Mets. And he became a very different manager when he went to the Mets. He knew the spotlight was on him with the expectation to entertain, not to be the great tactician he was with the Yankees. And so he kind of let his coaches run the games, select the pitching rotation. His center fielder, Richie Ashburn, a great player, would kind of run the game on the field, figure out who should be positioned where. And Casey might nod off in the dugout now and then. That was true. But by and large, he fulfilled his calling when the Mets hired him to put that team on the map.
Now, one of the things I found very interesting, out of so many things I found interesting in your book, is that the Mets were known as lovable losers when they first started out, but not by all the media. And there are some who are, even early on, even after the second and third year, they were getting a little impatient, and I think they were looking for Casey to step down for a new generation to step in and manage the Mets.
It is true. By the time they moved to Shea Stadium in their third year, there was a core of fans and even writers who were thinking, okay, the Casey experiment was fun, let's get somebody else and move forward. None more so than Howard Cosell, who was a vocal critic from the first year. He either didn't get or understand Casey Stengel, or he was more correct than everybody else was. It was one of those two. But by the time he retired after he broke his hip in 1965, I think the Mets were ready for that next step and ready to move on.
Now, I found it, I don't know if a coincidence is the right word, but your Stengel book comes out at the same time as a biography of another lifer, legend, player who later became manager, Leo Durocher. And can you talk a little bit about the contrast in their styles?
Well, Casey was a beloved figure in the game, and Leo had a harder edge to him. Not everybody was attracted to Leo as a personality. His associations were not as pleasant, let's say, as Casey's tended to be, but they were both highly well-known figures in baseball. I think you could ask the average person on the street half a century ago to name the 10 most famous people in baseball, and both of those guys would probably be on the list.
Did they have any kind of relationship? They faced each other in the World Series in 1951, I believe, but did they have any special cordiality or non-cordiality? Because I know DeRocher had a lot of negative things to say about a lot of people.
Yeah, there was no affection there. There was the on-field rivalry, and they almost came to blows at one point, too. that was not high on Casey's list of people he admired.
Now, DeRocher was notorious for not getting along with some of his younger players, especially when he was managing the Cubs. But Casey embraced what he liked to call the youth of America, especially in his later years with the Mets when people like Swoboda and Cleon Jones were coming up.
That's true, and the youth of America was one of his expressions, and he famously did a video which is preserved on YouTube where he talks about young babies being born and their first words will be, Metsies, Metsies, Metsies. A very colorful little interview he did there. Another famous quote of his was talking about two of his 20-year-old players and pointing to one and saying he could be on his way to the Hall of Fame in 10 years, and him, he'll be 30.
Now, when you were doing the research for Stengel, you obviously had a great wealth of source material. Was there something that really surprised you about him that you had never heard before?
Oh, good question. I was not surprised so much as just it was a revelation to learn about his years in retirement. He lived in a grand style in a beautiful home in Southern California in Glendale. He and his wife had a wonderful relationship, but near the end, near those last few years of Casey's life, Edna developed Alzheimer's disease, was put in an assisted living home, and Casey, even when they took away his driver's license in his 80s, he'd walk 2 miles to make sure to visit her every day. His love for her never waned, and it wore on him a lot that she was no longer in the house and his life partner was separated from him.
Now, I want to switch it up a little bit and talk about, again, the process of writing. You've written many books. Do you have a preference of doing a project on your own like this or Pinstripe Area, your history of the Yankees, as opposed to co-writing a book with, let's say, Ron Bloomberg or Eric Gregg?
I did a lot of those collaborations earlier on, but I think I enjoy doing it on my own the most. Because it's, my time schedule. I like to wake up early and write all morning and then finish up around 11 or 12 and have the rest of the day free. And that doesn't necessarily match what a co-author might want to do. I love research. And if you're doing a collaboration, there's less of that than just talking to your co-author. I love searching through the internet. I love my own library, which is more than 2,000 books. So I feel organized when I'm writing a book that follows in chronological order, and I get organized with file folders, with clippings put into each year. So it feels good for me. It's my process, and I've adapted to it.
What was your first book?
Well, the first book I did was called Baseball's Best, The Hall of Fame Gallery. McGraw-Hill published it in 1977 as biographies, 1,500 words on each of the Hall of Famers up to that point. And I remember lugging this very heavy electric typewriter with me as I traveled with the Yankees. I was still their PR director, but I was doing this while we were on the road. I'd get up early in the morning in the hotel room and plug in the typewriter and work at this. I don't know if I could do that again today, especially with all the Hall of Famers there are now. But the opportunity to do a first book, oh, I jumped at it. It was a great experience.
So 40 years as an author, you've obviously seen a lot of changes in the industry. And one of the knocks on the industry these days is that authors are called upon to do so much more themselves than they would have in the past, especially when it comes to publicity, public relations. But your background is in public relations, so you, I imagine, had an easier time of it than a lot of your fellow authors?
I suppose so, because of all my years of training to do that. But you have to remember, and I even was late in coming to this realization, but I've always been a public relations person. I've always been an author. And those are two very different personalities at play. The PR guy picks up the phone and gets into kind of gregarious conversation with people and is much more outgoing. And the writer tends to be, you know, more reclusive and huddled over the computer keyboard and working quietly. So those two personalities are sort of at play in my personality at all times.
Now, some authors find it a bit of a chore when it comes to doing appearances and interviews. You've always been a legendary storyteller. Do you still enjoy getting out and talking about your work?
Absolutely. This week alone, I've done several television interviews where I had the opportunity to tell stories, not just answer quickly Q&A formatted things like you do on talk radio a lot. So the ability to tell a story, I guess, goes back generations in my family. And let's face it, before there was radio, this was what people did. They sat around and told stories. And I guess I have that, some of that in my blood.
And we've been talking with Marty Appel, one of the great storytellers. Congratulations on the new book, Casey Stengel, Baseball's Greatest Character. And thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Ron. Appreciate it.
And that was the Bookshelf Conversation with Marty Appel. Tune in again next time, and well, you're actually not tuning in, are you? I'm bringing this to you. So anyway, next time I'll have another guest from the world of baseball literature and or pop culture. With or without the birds, I can't tell yet. In the meantime, please visit Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com for the latest news, reviews, yada, yada, yada. I just wanted to mention April is the month in which we have Tom Hofarth of the Los Angeles Daily News providing his very excellent series, 30 Books in 30 Days. That's 30 baseball titles in 30 days. And he highlights some of the hot titles as well as some that don't get the publicity they might deserve from mainstream media. So that's a great service that he provides. He writes the Farther Off the Wall column. You can Google that. I'll also be posting it on the blog from time to time. And in a little bit of shameless self-promotion, I just wanted to remind you that I have a book coming out at the end of the month, Hank Greenberg in 1938, Hatred and Home Runs in the Shadow of War. It's available now for pre-order on Amazon. I'll also be letting you know from time to time about my appearances, whether they be live at an event or on a radio or TV show or in a podcast. As a matter of fact, on Monday, when I post this conversation with Marty Appel, I will be the guest on the Baseball by the Book blog hosted by Justin McGuire, to discuss 501 baseball books fans must read before they die. that it was nice to go back and discuss something that I haven't really considered for a few years. So I hope you'll look that up on iTunes. In the meantime, thanks again for listening. Happy reading. Enjoy opening day. And I'll be talking to you soon.
Had seen Matty pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a wonderful game.
A little bit of shameless self-promotion. I have a new book coming out at the end of April. It's called Hank Greenberg in 1938, Hatred and Home Runs in the Shadow of War. I do hope you'll pick that up at some point along your baseball reading journeys. In the meantime, thanks for listening and tune in again soon. So long, everybody.